Thanks a lot for inviting me. I had a beautiful drive down the coast yesterday. It's great to be back in Santa Barbara. Today I'm going to tell you about something that I've been quite excited about for the past year, which is permutation orbifolds. And the talk will be based on two papers, one from last year and one from a few months ago with Christoph Keller and Alex Maloney. So let me start with our beloved Axtron. Einstein-Hilbert action in four-dimensional flat space, and at the classical level, this gives us general relativity that we all love and that we can study and understand in quite a lot of detail, and we can use it to compare with astrophysics and try to understand if supermassive black holes have a spin or not, for instance. But okay, let's be a little bit more optimistic and say, I want to understand quantum gravity. So what do you do in principle? Well, you start from this action, this classical action, and then you just quantize. And as I'm sure all of you know, that doesn't work. Just essentially by dimensional analysis, you can see that this theory is non-normalizable. So okay, if you want to have a UV-complete theory of quantum gravity, you've got to add something. And this is going to lead me to the first question that I'm going to try to address today. Question one is really, how much stuff do you need to add? Or what's the minimal amount of stuff that you need to add to have a UV-complete theory? Now, of course, we know one answer in string theory, that's a UV-complete theory, that contains gravity, but it contains also a lot of other things. And then for string theory, the answer to that question is really a lot. You have to add an infinite tower of massive fields. But you can ask, you know, is that general? Is there other possible constructions? And so on and so forth. I think it's fair to say that our best understanding of quantum gravity comes from the ADS-CFT correspondence that does involve string theories. It involves them in different regimes, and probably the regime that we understand the best is the one where the ADS length is much bigger than the string length, which is much bigger than the Planck length. And you know it with the usual notion that this is controlled by the TOOF coupling, and this is controlled by some parameter n, which in the canonical example of n equals 4 super Young Mills is the rank of the gauge group. And so you can ask, what does the theory look like? Okay, the ADS scale is much bigger than the string scale, so at low energies you have supergravity, and then as you crank up the energy, you start to see the stringy degrees of freedom appear, and all this is still way below the Planck scale. So inspired by these ideas of ADS-CFT, you can sort of ask the question in the opposite direction. If this was a sort of bottom-up approach, you can ask top-down question, which would be, among the theory of quantum gravities, which have a well-behaved semi-classical limit? And if you understand the answer to that question, let me call this question 2A. Question 2B, you can ask, okay, and what do these theories look like? Are they string theories? Are they local quantum field theories? What do they look like? Okay, and I should stop at this point and define what I mean by semi-classical limit. I might use the words weakly coupled or semi-classical a lot. I will always mean only one thing, is that the ADS is much bigger than 1. Okay, this is roughly n, and this is what I mean by semi-classical limit. I mean that gravitational back reaction is small. I'm not assuming anything about locality, such that like the theory needs to be local on the ADS scale, so I would be perfectly happy with a classical string theory, but I want G string to be small. This is only what I'll mean by semi-classical limit all along this talk. Okay, and in fact, so this was the sort of bottom-up approach. This is more of a top-down. You start from the UV complete and you ask if the semi-classical limit makes sense. And in fact, I'll be addressing more this direction today than the first question. Now, of course, answering these questions in full generality is at best extremely hard, more reasonably probably impossible. So we got to make a set of restrictions. So I'm going to make two restrictions. The first one is I'm going to talk about theories of gravity in ADS and not in flat space. I want to be able to use the powers of ADS CFT. So I got to restrict to ADS. And second, I'm actually going to restrict to ADS 3 CFT2, which is a very special example. As you probably know, just pure gravity in three dimensions is topological. It doesn't have propagating degrees of freedom. Also, 2D CFTs are very special. They're a lot more constrained because of the Virzaro symmetry. And so we'll start by trying to answer this question. If we can't even answer this question here, you know, we can forget about this program, quit our jobs, go home, and think about a good startup idea or something. Usually I see join a bank because I'm Swiss, but I hear that in California, the trendy thing is to start a startup, so. Okay, so those are the restrictions that I'll be making today. And how does this work in ADS3 CFT2? There's the famous relation first derived by Brown and Hanau, that the central charge is 3 times the ADS radius over 2 g newton. And so what will be my starting point? I'm going to say that every theory, every 2D CFT, gives me a theory of quantum gravity in ADS3. Now, you might object to this and say, no, but hold on. If the central charge is small, I'm off to a pretty bad start. This is not going to be holographic or geometric in any sense. And you're right. I mean, usually there's a set of conditions that we demand such that, you know, large C, sparse spectrum, and so on and so forth. But in principle, this 2D CFT has a set of correlators. And I'm free to interpret these correlators as some scattering amplitude in a theory of 3D gravity, quantum gravity. It might be fully quantum, non-geometric, and so on and so forth. But in principle, you know, formally, I can just think about these correlators as defining some quantities in the theory of quantum gravity in ADS3. Now, we're interested in the semi-classical limit. So what we really want is not just one CFT. We really want a family of CFTs labeled by a parameter n and to have their central charge proportional to n. So if this is the space of all 2D CFTs, we want to look at some sort of path in this space, and each point here is a CFT labeled by a parameter n, and we want to take the n goes to infinity limit. And we want to ask that this theory is well-behaved. What do I mean by that? Let me be a little bit more precise. So, you know, we have CFTs labeled by a parameter n, and we want to take n to infinity and call this C infinity. CFTn, sorry. Okay, now imagine looking just at the partition function, for instance, which is the sum over the states in your theory times the density of states times this Boltzmann factor here. And let's imagine defining such a thing for every number n. And now what we demand for the theory to be well-behaved is that for any finite delta, fixed finite delta, as we send n to infinity, let me write, can you see if I write here? Yeah. We ask that the following limit exists and is finite. Okay, so for any finite delta, as you take n to infinity, you have to have some convergence here. This is convergence of the spectrum. We want to have a finite number of states at low energies. And, you know, in the dictionary, what does this mean in terms of the gravity theory? It means that you only have a finite number of perturbations above the ADS vacuum. Okay, and then you would also ask some other properties such as convergence of the correlation functions and so on and so forth. And indeed, this is, we'll talk about this a little bit later. And these are the conditions that we will demand. But we'll see that this already highly restricts what we can do. And this is what I'll call having a well-behaved semi-classical limit. Now I should pause at this point and make one important comment. I'm not going to be talking about black hole states. Black hole states have an energy that scale with C. So as you take C to infinity, they have an infinite energy, and they sort of drop out of the spectrum. I'm only, the way I've defined rho infinity, it only captures states of finite delta. So I'm throwing away all the high energy states, and I'm keeping only the low-lying spectrum. For that reason, if you tried to build a partition function out of rho infinity, it would not be modular invariant, because you've thrown out the high energy stuff, so you can't use the S transform. Okay, so the goal here is to, you know, study these theories and study these families of CFTs and take n to infinity and see if they have a finite number of states at the low-lying level. Now,
sorry, you're not going to require that something you calculate on the field theory side agrees with Einstein gravity and this?
That will be the part two, which will be, what do these theories look like? Are they, that's precisely something that we're trying to answer. Do they look like Einstein gravity? Maybe they will and maybe they won't. I'll keep the surprise for a little bit later. That's the second part of the question. After finding which ones exist, then you ask, what do they look like? Now, I wish I could do this. I've already restricted quite a lot. I'm sorry, I'm going to... Yes?
You're restricting the essence of delta to be polynomial in delta or something like that?
You mean the number row of delta?
Yeah.
That's what we're going to see.
Okay.
If it's a if it has a certain behavior, it's going to be a local quantum field theory. If it has another behavior, it might be a string theory, and so on and so forth. And that's precisely what will come out of this. What was I saying? Yes. Yeah, so I've already restricted quite a lot. I'm going to have to restrict even more, and I apologize. But as far as I know, there's no complete classifications of all 2D CFTs. So we're going to have to restrict to some subset. Okay, and these are permutation orbifolds. And we'll focus on this subset. We'll see that it's probably just a tiny subset of all 2D CFTs, but it's already very rich and it has a lot of structure. And, you know, we can hope to draw some conclusions for more general CFTs. Okay, so what's the plan for today? That was my introduction. I'm now going to tell you about permutation orbifolds. I will tell you how we construct them. Then we'll demand that the spectrum is well behaved when we take n to infinity. This will give us a set of constraints, and it will push me to introduce oligomorphic permutation groups. Then I'll give you a set of examples. And then we'll talk precisely about your question, what does the spectrum look like? What do we get out of this? And at the end, we'll see, depending how time goes, I'll talk about the correlation functions and large N factorization. Okay. Is there any questions at this point about what I'm going to do? Okay. So if I tell you what's the easiest way to construct a 2D CFT or a family of 2D CFTs with large central charge, what would you do? You'll say, oh, okay, let me take my favorite CFT C with central charge, well, cosmological constant, with central charge C, okay? And you'll say, okay, let me just take the nth tensor product of that, and that's going to have central charge n times C. Okay, easiest way. You pick your favorite 2D CFT, criticalizing model, whatever you want to pick, and then you just take n copies of it, and you'll build a theory that has a large central charge. Now, obviously, this is going to fail this right away, because if your theory had one state at level 1, you take n copies of it, it's going to have n states at level 1, and when you take n to infinity, it's not going to converge. So you need to do something. So what are we going to do here? We're going to quotient this by Gn, and Gn is some subset of the symmetric group. Okay, there's a global symmetry here, which is a permutation of any of the copies of the CFT up here. So you have some global symmetry. You're free to quotient by any subgroup of the symmetric group. Okay, and this here is what we're going to call Cn. And now your hope is that, you know, this gets rid of a lot of the states. So if you're lucky or if you're smart and you make the group big enough in some sense, you're going to get rid of all the states, or almost all the states, and you'll have a finite number of states at low energies. Now, doing this orbifold doesn't just throw out states, it also adds twisted sectors. So we'll have to be a little bit careful about see how the twisted sectors come in. Can they give us back some kind of divergence? And so on and so forth. Okay. Now, you should really be thinking about this as some gauge theory. At the end of the day, if you think about ADS CFT, why are all the dualities that we know of, why do they contain gauge theories? Well, generically, if you try to build a theory that has a large number of degrees of freedom, it'll have a large number of states at the low-lying level. Take n bosons, it'll have too much states at the low-lying level. So you've got to project out a lot of the states. And that's why you gauge the symmetry, it enforces Gauss's law, it projects out most of the states, and if you're lucky and you do it well, you get a theory with a finite number of states at the low-lying level. And you should think about this procedure as the 2D equivalent of that. Turns out in 2D you have orbifold, so you can do things a little bit differently, but this is really the equivalent of that. And you take out a lot of the states, you don't do just that. When you gauge a symmetry, you add the gauge field, there's holonomies, you can add certain degrees of freedom. Here you add twisted states, that's the equivalent of doing that. Okay, so what's the goal? The goal is to find out which GN work. Within our class of theories, this will be answering question 2A. Among all possible choices here, which give us a well-behaved semi-classical image? Which GN work? And then we'll ask, okay, once we found out which one work, what do these theories look like? Can we find the spectrum? Okay, and this will be answering question 2B. And we can use techniques that we know from 2D CFTs to try to answer that. And then the third question will be to look at their correlation functions. Is there any generic behavior of the correlation functions? Which would be a question 2C that I didn't write down about what the scattering amplitudes look like. Okay, so that's the goal for today. Now to do that, I'm going to need to tell you a little bit about the states of such a theory. So let's look at our theory C cross N mod GN. Oops. As I said, there's two kind of states. There's the untwisted sector and the twisted sector. What is the untwisted sector? Well, if the original CFT had a Hilbert space H, you just take n copies of that, and then you project out by the group Gn. So you're throwing away all the states that are not invariant under the action of the group. Fairly easy. What's the twisted sector? It's a little bit more complicated. You get one twisted sector per conjugacy class of the group. And it's just, if you're, for the people that are not familiar with orbifolds, it's just degrees of freedom where you twist your fields by elements of the group. For instance, if you have two free bosons that are periodic, a twisted sector will be one where once you go around the circle, you come back to the second boson, not to the first one, and then you go around that circle and come back to yourself, for instance. And now you have a permutation group, so you can go to, you have a twisted sector with, you know, CFTs 1, 2, 3, 4, and then 5, 6, 7 can be in one cycle, and you can do any number of things, so it can be quite complicated. And in general, you get one twisted sector by conjugacy class of the group. Conjugacy classes of the symmetric group are fairly well understood. For general permutation groups, it's a lot more complicated. Okay, let me start by explaining the untwisted sector, which is, let's say, the easy part. Let me define a pre-state, phi, which is going to be a function of two vectors, k and phi. K is a vector of integers, of distinct integers. Okay, and phi is a vector of states of the seed theory, of the original CFT that I started with. And what's the notation here? Okay, let me give you an example. Imagine k is 2, 3, 7, and phi is phi 1, phi 9, phi 27, let's say. This tells you that CFT number 2 is excited in state phi 1, CFT number 3 is excited in state phi 9, and CFT number 7 is excited in state 27. So this state is a state that belongs in the product theory. It's just some excited state that you can build in the product theory. However, obviously, it won't be invariant under the action of the group. If GN was the permutation group, well, this is not symmetric under the exchange of the CFTs 2 and 3. So this, out of this pre-state, how do you get a real true state of the theory? A true state, phi, is going to be the sum over all elements of the group going to try to keep that. So let me put it down here. Okay, what's the notation here? The element of the group G acts on the vector of integers. This is a permutation, so it sends 2 to 27, 3 to 81, 7 to 4. This state is invariant, it only has three states, so all the rest of the action is unimportant. But in general, you sum over every single element of the group acting on this vector. You don't touch the states stay the same. You just change which CFT is excited in which state. And by summing over all the group, you're assured that this is invariant now under the action of GN.
You're normalizing the state?
Yes. In principle, you need up to normalization. You need to normalize the state. I'll talk about that a little bit more when I talk about correlation functions. Now, the goal here is really to count the number of states. So for that, we don't really need to worry too much about the normalization. Okay. So with this building block in mind, now we can ask the question, how do we impose that we have a finite number of states? Okay. So let me define the following quantities. Fk, the number of unordered orbits of GN, FK, I guess I should call it UK. Oh, sorry, on K tuples. I'll explain this in a second. The number of ordered orbits of GN on k-tuples. What does this mean? It means take k-tuples, act with a group on it, and count how many different states you can make. And this is given by the number of the orbits of the group on k-tuples. Okay? And now, to have a finite number of states, so there's also hanging around here, there's also the density of states of your seed theory. But those are all finite numbers. We're going to keep k finite, so they don't really matter. The only thing that could go wrong is that you have too many orbits.
Sorry, what's an ordered orbit versus an unordered orbit?
It depends on if you take all states here to be the same, it's some combinatorial factor that appears. If you take all states to be the same, then there's less different ways that you can permute them, because changing these two won't matter. If they're all different, there's more. In principle...
The number of orbits of GN acting on ordered or unordered k-tuples.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, sorry, what... Right. Yeah. Yes, sorry. That's what I meant. It turns out that it doesn't really matter because, you know, the ordered ones are bounded by k factorial times the unordered ones. As long as we're keeping k finite, you can just look at whether these numbers stay finite as you take n to infinity. Okay, and this is our criteria to have a finite number of states and so to have a well-defined semi-classical limit. So we just need to check all groups, potentially hard question, but need to check all groups that have finite number of orbits on k-tuples, ordered or not. And so we can already very quickly see what's going on here. Sn is going to work. OK, Okay, this is not a surprise. This is the CFT, or the symmetric product that appears in the D1, D5 system that is fairly well understood. In this case, Fk equals Fk equals 1. It's just one orbit. But then you might ask, oh, okay, what about the cyclic group? The answer is no. This doesn't work. You can see very easily you take on one tuple, you're fine. Here's one. You go to two tuples, there's n. You're already screwed. Okay, so this gives you some sort of ideas of notion. This goes like n to the n in terms of number of elements. This has n elements, so there must be some kind of hierarchy of groups. Some are going to work, others are not going to work. Okay, and it turns out that there's a name for these things, names for group permutation groups on sort of infinite number of elements. They're called oligomorphic groups. Oligomorphic groups are groups of permutation that have a finite number of orbits on ordered or not k-tuples as you take n to infinity. They've been studied by mathematicians, and in particular by Cameron. There's a lot of very interesting features about this group, a lot of which I don't understand and have no good understanding of what it means physically. For instance, so if you know and have any ideas, I'd be really interested. There's one property of oligomorphic groups, is that Fk is polynomial in k, or bigger than e to the square root of k. There's a gap. What does it mean? I don't know. There's a gap. It cannot be anything in between this. Okay. There's also crazy examples, like the automorphisms of the random graph has Fk that's like e to the k squared. This is super Hagedorn. It's a crazy growth of number of states. Okay, now the problem is all these theorems and all these things that are known for oligomorphic groups. And those are defined, strictly speaking, as you've taken the limit n goes to infinity. What we really want here is a family. We want to have groups at finite n, and we want to be able to take n to infinity. What these things really, for instance, this example, there's no sort of way to truncate it to finite n and then send to infinity. Because the random graph, if you truncate it at any finite n, doesn't have all these nice properties. So it's not clear how much of this we can learn. These would be sort of examples of purely classical gravity. You've taken n to infinity, there's no way to go to finite n. But in any case, there's these interesting results, and we know.
What is the definition of these groups?
An oligomorphic group is a group that has a finite, is a permutation group where you send the number of elements to infinity and has a finite number of orbits. That's just an oligomorphic group.
It's a definition for n equals
infinity? It's a definition for n equals infinity. It doesn't tell you anything about finite n.
But the mathematicians must surely have a way. I mean, you're saying you take n to infinity, so.
Yes, so the problem is, yeah, so clearly I have a notion, some sort of limit where you have terms by terms. For the random graph is this graph where you take two points and connect them with probability 1/2, and then when you take n to infinity, all of a sudden it has all these nice properties, and they can show that the group, the automorphisms group is like oligomorphic. But, okay, I'm not sure.
They prove it by some limiting process?
I think so. They tell you that, yes. It's like, and I mean,
surely
yes.
If something converges to something, then
yes, but the,
it must have some other property.
I think so, but the problem is that, well, okay. What I know for a fact is that if you take the random graph, there's different ways that you can truncate to finite n that will give you the same limit. So it seems you can approach it by different, so telling you what your theory is at finite n is sort of ambiguous because there's sort of more than one way that you can reach the point, from what I understand.
And what, aside from that, what are the other examples of such a group?
So this is what I'm going to turn to now. I want to give you examples. Because you might tell me, okay, this is great. You've told me that Sn works, maybe only in the sort of usual groups, maybe only Sn works. And what I want to do now is, I'm sorry if this is a little bit abstract. I know people usually yawn at this point or fall asleep. But
before you go on,
yes?
I'm confused about your definition. I need to understand something. So
this
K is just some list of some subset of the set of copies you've got.
Yes.
Okay. I don't. So that means that if I want to, and I can choose then the states in your phi vector to be any states I like.
So with finite energy, yes.
So take them all through the vacuum, say. Are you saying that if you're at C sub n, there are was it n plus one different states in the orbifold theory I can form just using the vacuum as ingredient?
No, sorry, the vacuum is unique. If you take k to be just zero, the zero vector, phi is all states are in the vacuum, then no matter what permutation.
Here's my question.
Yes.
If I take k to be when you've got 2, 3, 7.
Yes.
And I choose phi 1, phi 3, yeah. phi 7 to all be the vacuum states of their theories.
Oh,
what
this
states
is.
Does that give?
Oh, okay. This is all non-vacuum states.
Ah.
Yes. Everything that's not here is in the vacuum. This means that. Okay, sorry.
And non-vacuum, you mean orthogonal to the vacuum state?
Yes.
With finite energy.
Yeah. I mean, okay, that's it. It's a linear algebra construction. Everything's orthogonal to the vacuums.
That's right, yeah.
I see. Okay, non-vacuum states.
Yes. And everything that's not indicated here is in the vacuum.
All right, then I understand.
So one thing that I did not say, and I should quickly come back to this, although I don't want to prove it because it takes long for not a lot of good physics, it turns out that oligomorphic groups also have a finite number of twisted states. In the twisted states, you need to sum over the conjugacy classes, and it turns out that you can, you know, rebuild this back into a sum over the entire group, and the fact that you have a finite number of states is sort of a very similar. Yes.
Just about that.
Yes.
You take SM to infinity, the permutation group has an infinite number of conjugacy classes, then that's not a partition.
Yes, but at every time you need to project out by summing over the centralizer.
Oh, there's at least one twisted sector per conjugacy class, and the number of conjugacy classes grows with n, which is the number of partitions of n.
That's right.
So
yes,
you have to tell
right.
me that the energy somehow is growing or something like that. So that
no.
twisted sector states.
Yes, so that's absolutely right. These are finite energy states. So just like I'm not authorizing you to take infinite energy states or states that grow with n, I'm not letting you take twisted sectors of arbitrarily long length, because those would have infinite energies. The energy of a twisted state, I shouldn't really call it a ground state, but the minimum energy of a twisted sector state is proportional to the length. You know, it's proportional to like n minus 1 over n, where n is the number of elements in the cycle. This is if you have just one cycle.
I'm confused about this point, but I'll...
We can maybe take it offline, yeah.
I must be missing something in my brain. Because I'm thinking of the long strings.
Yes.
In the big sector,
so they're important.
Zero, and...
Long strings are important. But I'm not letting you take arbitrarily long string. I want to keep the size of the string finite, if you want.
Well, I understand that. I just don't understand how that keeps the energy finite. So.
Okay, maybe we should.
That's not the issue.
Maybe let's just take this offline, and let me go on for now.
Since you haven't actually defined twisted sector in detail, do I understand that that's a construction which is well defined, given an arbitrary abstract CFT?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Absolutely.
It's purely algebraic construction, doesn't require the Lagrangian description, it's just something you can
yeah,
do. Yeah, okay.
That's right.
So could you clarify
yes.
something? This FOM can compute this number of untwisted sector for fixed?
It computes the number of orbits, then if you really want to know the number of states, now it becomes dependent on how many states of given energy you have in the seed theory.
Yeah. Okay.
So that'll be highly dependent on what the seed theory is. But the fact that because the seed theory already has a finite number of states, the fact that we're demanding that the total number of states is finite will not depend on that. The number itself will depend on that. But as I'll discuss later when I talk about the spectrum, it turns out that there's universal properties that don't even depend on that at all. But I'll get to that in a second. First, I want to give you some examples. Okay. So this was all great. What do I do with this? What examples do I have? So as I said, the symmetric group works. The cyclic group doesn't work. What else do I have? Now you can do sort of trivial examples where you take Sn over 2 cross Sn over 2. It's a little bit boring. I want to give you sort of non-trivial things. Okay, Example one, the Reith product. What is the Reith product? The Reith product is, imagine taking, or maybe I should do S square root of n, which is in Sn. OK, you take square root of n CFTs. You do a symmetric product orbifold fold. You take that as your building block. You take square root of n of those. And then you do a symmetric product orbifold fold. OK? That's what it is. This has size n plus has order asymptotically, which is, you know, smaller than n to the n, which is of the symmetric group. What's my favorite way of thinking about what the Reith product is? Imagine you put your n CFTs in a square root of n by square root of n matrix. Okay, each of these blocks here is a CFT. And now I excite this guy, this guy, this guy, this guy, this guy. What is the action of the Reith product? You get one Sn per line. So you can permute the things on every line independently. And once you're done, you have one final Sn that permutes the lines together. OK? So you can show that with this action of the group, for any finite number of crosses that I put here for any state, I can always use the symmetry to put them in a k squared choose k box, a box of k squared choose k by k squared choose k. And so the number of orbits is always finite, because at most, that's the number of things you have. OK? And so this is one example. And I'll tell you a little bit more about it when I talk about the spectrum. But this says, OK, but wait, hold on. If you can do this, what about this guy here? S square root of n cross S square root of n in Sn. This is not the sort of stupid example where I took n over 2. This is, and this is much smaller now, this is like n to the square root of n. Okay, it starts to be quite smaller than n to the n. And what's the action here? Well, it's really essentially the same thing as before. But instead of giving you one permutation on every line, one independent permutation on every line, I give you one permutation for all lines. And then one permutation to move the lines again like before. OK, so instead of having one independent Sn per line, S square root of n per line, you only have one. But still, you have enough symmetry here to bring all the crosses to one k squared choose k by k squared choose k box. And the fact that you can bring this to this finite size box, if you want, tells you that you have a finite number of orbits. The number of orbits is the different ways you can move these crosses around, but they'll always stay in this box. So this guy, again, is oligomorphic. Starts to get pretty small. How small can you make this? You can show by using, I don't really want to go through the derivation, but you can show by using, you know, convergence of the untwisted sector density of states that Gn has to be bigger than n to the k for any k. Or let me call it L, because I've used. OK, so it has to grow faster than polynomial. But you can sort of ask, how small can I make it? And it turns out that using these kinds of ideas, you can go even further. You can say, what about if I do this? K times. Okay, and now instead of putting my CFTs in a square root of n by square root of n matrix, I put them in a tensor, a rank k, in a tensor. Okay, and then act with all the Sn's on the different indices of the tensor. And now this starts to have the size n to the n to the 1 over k. For any k, you can, for any finite k, you can do this. Starts to be pretty small. You start to get very close to the polynomial. OK, these are all examples. I just wanted to give you sort of an idea of what things you can build and how small you can build these groups. Anything built out of Zn's will not work, though. So even if you take, I don't know, the Reith product of Zn by Zn, that's not going to work. If you take Sn Reith Zn, that works. That's, in fact, what you need to do if you want to study Renyi entropies of the symmetric product orbifold. That's the kind of things you'll have. OK, in any case, this was just to give you a few examples. Now what I really want to talk about is the spectrum. I don't know how much time I have left, 15 minutes roughly. OK. So what about the spectrum? So what are the possible outcomes? Let's start by that. If you get a local quantum field theory, what you expect is something of the following form. Okay, the density of states of a local quantum field theory is of the following form. Local quantum field theory. You know, this density of states is what gives you that the free energy is proportional to T to the D, etc. This is what we're used to. Okay, that's one thing. If it's a string theory, we get an exponential density of states. This is the Hagedorn behavior. Okay, you could expect more exotic things in between, maybe. You could expect a theory that has different scales, like the one that we talked about at first, n equals 4 super Yang Mills. There's the string scale and the Planck scale. We're always below the Planck scale, but if you're below the string scale, it looks like a local quantum field theory. And if you reach higher, it should look like, once you reach above the string scale, it should look like a string theory. So you can ask, you know, what do we get here? And what I'll show you is that, in fact, for our case, we get something that's bigger. This is sort of the punchline. So if you want to wake up for half a second, then you can go back to sleep. We'll show that the density of states always grow faster than x but delta over log delta. This is super quantum field theory. This is faster than a local quantum field theory to any number of dimensions. It's not quite Hagedorn because we have a log, but it's already faster than local quantum field theory. So within this construction, you cannot get supergravity. You cannot get some compactification down to ADS3 of supergravity. Is this surprising? No. What did we do here? An orbital fold, but it's essentially a theory. We took n non-interacting copies. Yes, we quotient, but we didn't really do anything interesting. I mean, well, I shouldn't say that, but we didn't do anything. We didn't go to strong coupling in any sense. Okay, indeed, what you need to do in the D1, D5 system that we understand, you need to deform, move on moduli space, and go to strong coupling. We didn't do that here. So, you know, if I told you that free Yang Mills had a stringy density of states, you wouldn't be surprised. That's just how it works. So it's not really surprising that we get something very stringy here. Okay, but let me just show you quickly how you get to this. So let me look at the density of states, rho delta coming from, First, the first thing is that I'm gonna only talk about the untwisted sector density of states to start with, because that's the easy thing to do. Because Gn is included in Sn, it means that rho Gn is bigger or equal to rho Sn. Okay, you project out less states, so you have more states that remain in your theory. And now let me look at the contribution from a K-tuple. Okay, so rho of Sn, which is going to be our lower bound, I'll just remind you that Fk equals big Fk equals 1. For the symmetric product, so in that case it's a little bit easier. So what do we get? What kind of contribution do we get from a K-tuple? Well, we have 1 over some combinatorial number times the int, and then there's still a delta that. Okay, you need to look at all possible ways that you can take the different deltas, such as the total energy is delta. And let me make 2 approximations. The first one is that we're in the Cardi regime. So these are 2 assumptions, I should say, sorry. I'll just make them for now, and then we'll check that they're actually right in 5 minutes. So I'm going to say that rho of delta I is Cardi. When I mean Cardi with respect to the central charge of the seed theory, okay, the central charge of the orbifold theory has been sent to infinity. But if you look at them, if you look at deltas that are much bigger than C of the seed theory, you should be allowed to use the Cardi formula. And then I'm also going to assume that the number of states. Okay, then once I have this, e to the square root of delta I is the number of states that I have at dimension delta I. I'm going to assume that this is much bigger than k. So you have a lot more states to choose from than the states that you're choosing. If this is the case, this simplifies a little bit. First of all, I can replace all the rho i's by the Cardi growth. And then the combinatorial factors becomes just k factorial. Because, you know, if the number of states that you can choose from is much bigger than the ones that you choose, all of them are distinct. So you can just replace the combinatorial by a k factorial. And then you start playing around. You do a bunch of saddle point approximations. You find that this thing is maximized when delta I is delta over k. OK, you replace that in here. You'll get a growth. You'll get something that looks like 1 over k factorials times square root of k times delta. Again, you do a saddle point approximation to check what values of k give you the biggest contribution at a given dimension delta. This gives you that k is roughly delta over log delta squared. Using this, you can check that for delta big enough, we're in the Cardy regime. And you can also check that this property here is true. So as long as delta is much bigger than C of the seed theory, these assumptions that I made here are valid. You plug everything back in, and what you get that rho of delta is here x of delta over log delta. And this was just a lower bound because we only did this for Sn. So we've bounded by below the density of states of all these examples here. So they're at least like this. You can ask me what happens for the other examples that you look like that you looked at, where you have different groups that are smaller. In full generality, you can't calculate them, but for the Reith product, you can calculate them because it's the number of partitions, the number of orbits, and so you get a correction to that. And it turns out, actually, for the Reith product, it's delta over log log delta. Starting to be pretty close to Hagedorn. Okay, and you can wonder, is it possible to get Hagedorn growth just from the untwisted sector? This is not what happens for the symmetric product. For the symmetric product, you really need the twisted sectors. The answer is we don't know. It would be really interesting to find out. But these other examples where I talked about the direct product, like f square root of n, in those cases, you don't have a formula for the number for fk. So it's kind of hard to give a definite answer. But it's possible. OK, so just very, very quickly, let me tell you about the twisted sector. How do you see that you get actually Hagedorn growth for how do you get Hagedorn growth in the symmetric product? OK, for Sn, if you look at the contribution, so remember you need to look at all conjugacy class. For the symmetric group, the conjugacy classes are the Young diagrams. So if you look at a given Young diagram, this is saying take 1, 2, 3, take L CFTs, twist them together, and everybody else don't do anything at all. This gives a contribution to the partition function of the form and you can check this by a formula given by Bante some time ago about general permutation orbifolds, and this is just one contribution. And then from this, you start playing again. You do Cardy behavior. You see that this is valid as long as the length here is much bigger than C of the seed theory. You plug it back in. You do saddle points. You maximize. And you see that from this, you get that rho is e to the 2 pi delta. So the Hagedorn density of states really comes from the long strings that are getting very large. And you can ask, OK, how does this fit in to our more general construction where you have a general permutation group? And the problem there is that you don't know that. If you had such an element, all the formulas still apply, so you would get the same growth. But you don't know that you have such an element or that you have such an element for any L sufficiently large. In principle, it could be very complicated. So we're able to show that if you have many cycles that are much larger than C, then you still get a Hagedorn growth. The problem is that you could even get maybe super Hagedorn. If you had a lot of very short cycles, then we have no control because you can't use, you know, if all the LIs are 2, you can't use Cardy. We don't know what happens. So for a generic group GN, we're not able to show that you actually get exactly Hagedorn, or that you get only Hagedorn. It could be super Hagedorn. So that's still sort of work in progress. We hope to be able to answer that in the future, but so far we can't. But in any case, we showed, you know, to answer question 2b, within our examples, they grow at least faster than any local quantum field theory in any number of dimensions. Okay, so let me just take the last 5 minutes to tell you about factorization. Now, one thing that's expected of holographic theories is something called large N factorization. My favorite way to understand this is that correlation functions, let's look at some four-point function in the CFT, they're given by Witten diagrams in ADS. And so if you have something like this, that will be dominant over anything like this, because all bulk coupling constants are suppressed by powers of 1 over n. This means that to leading order in n, the correlation functions factorize in the CFT. This is something very generic expected of holographic theories. And you can ask, do you see any kind of similar feature in your construction? And the answer is yes. Okay, let's look at a three-point function, phi 1, phi 2, phi 3, where the phis were constructed by taking pre-states and then summing over the group. Okay, and just to draw sort of a picture, these are all the different CFTs. And for instance, phi 1 would have, you know, three excited states, phi 2 would have, or let's say 4, and phi 2 would also have, or maybe 5 excited states. This continues. Phi 3 has, four excited states. Now, the only thing I'm going to assume here is that the states of the seed theory are orthonormal. Okay, and now you need to compute this correlation function. It's very complicated because each of these guys uses a sum over the entire group that's going to permute where the excited states are along this line. And you have three sums, one for each state. But what you need to do is you need to align states. Every time you have a column with just one state, that'll give you zero, because, you know, the one-point functions are zero, essentially. And then every time you have two states, well, you get a contribution of one. Every time you have three states, you'll get, you know, the OPE of the OPE coefficients of the seed theory. And let me just call this here N3, which is the number of three-point overlaps. And everything else is just two-point overlaps. Okay? And then all you need to do, really, it's combinatorics. You need to check out how many possibilities, how many elements of the group permute this in a way that I get zero. And what you can show is that this gives you the sum of a product of two-point functions of the seed theory plus things that look like this, but these guys comes with suppressed powers of 1 over n. We can show it exactly for the symmetric group. We can show it exactly for the Riesz product. We can show it. This involves knowing what the stabilizer subgroups of Gn are, because you need always to check how many elements of the group can I use to permute the vacuums around. And this is where normalization becomes important, because now you need to take all of that into account. We can show it for all these groups. We can show it for any group that we call democratic, which is groups that have all orbits of roughly the same size. Not clear which groups fall in that category, but if it's the case, we can prove this. So we expect it to be true for probably all our examples, although we weren't quite able to prove it. And so this tells you that you have a notion of large N factorization. Every time as you have a three-point overlap, it's suppressed in powers of 1 over N, and this is something, you know, expected of holographic theories. So with that being said, I think I'm out of time, so let me stop here. Thanks a lot.
Is this sum always converges for this oligo? So
the yes.
Okay.
Yes. Once you take into account normalization of the states correctly, yes.
Okay.
And we've normalized here all states such that their norm is 1, which is not what you usually do with the stress tensor. Stress tensor has norm n, or square root of n. That's why if you put like, you know, TOO or something like that, you get 1 over n, but that's because we haven't normalized it in the usual way that we do in ADS-CFT.
I think large n factorization was originally discussed completely independent of holography, right? I mean, didn't
you have to say that, you know,
sure, in the context of n being the end of the symmetry group, but this is large n factorization.
It's a different n.
Different n.
Not the gauge group.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's the gauge group in some
different
difference. Yeah.
It's a global symmetry.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Does factorization hold for gauge for any 4-point function?
Within this, for the ones we can prove it, yes, I believe, yes, it does.
So you prove.
We have for the symmetric group, we do. We don't have it for a general GN.
So suppose that you have this rho infinity.
Yes.
For this finite delta sector, I mean, can we use the modular invariance to constrain the an operator content, which is order of central charge?
Oh, you're asking now about high energy states?
Yeah.
I mean, the problem is the whole approach that we took here is fix the dimension, send n to infinity. Once you do that, you've thrown out the black holes. So now you can ask me what happens if you sort of make delta much, much smaller than n, keep n finite. Most of what I said applies. But I don't know really what you get out of using like S transform there. It's sort of the route we approach is to just to look at the low lying energy and throw out all the black holes and that kind of stuff. So all states that scale with C have been thrown out.
So can you also count primaries in these
theories? Well, I mean, I think that's what we're counting, the number of
states. But so if you take some non-primary states from the descendants, then those can, in some situations, become primary.
Okay.
Are they counting all states?
Yeah, I mean, this is...
Yes, that's right. But,
your question is whether they have an important contribution, like if descendant states have an important contribution? Is that your question?
Basically, it is. Or it's just a...
Yeah, I'm not sure. I would have to think about that.
And can you remind me, I can't remember the translation in my head. If I take a standard ADS-3 holographic theory, you know, I expect that the three-point function is not just suppressed relative to the two-point function, but by a particular power of Newton's constant and thus a particular power of n. This is the right power of n? You know, if I compare it with the...
That's a good question.
Some such
thing. Yes, I think so. Well, okay, I'm not sure exactly how to answer that question. I think if N3 is 1, then yes, you get the appropriate scaling, because this is like...
What was N3
again? N3 is a number of 3 state overlaps. So if only three CFTs have a 3-point overlap, if there's only 1 3-point overlap, then you get the appropriate power. Then in the 4-point function, you would get 1 over n, and I think that's what you expect. The problem is I'm not sure what you do with the cases that have multi-point overlaps.
I should have asked it differently. I guess I should have said if this is something like a gravity theory of the kind you would expect, then this tells you that G scales with N as some power of N3.
Yeah, that's fixed. That's fixed.
And if David asked about the 4-point functions, do those involve a separate variable N4, or do they again involve N3 if it's a pressure of the 4-point function?
They would have N4. Well, they would have both. It would have an,
okay,
right.
So the generic theory of this kind does not have a holographic dual, which has the general structure that we see the large number of string theory, where everything comes with a common number of powers.
Where all coupling constants
are. Coupling constants go like G, yeah.
I don't think so. I'm not sure. I would have to think about that more.
Arbitrary in 3 and 4 and 5.
Yeah.
Obviously, they'd have to be linearly related.
Right.
No, but N3 is the number of coincidences, right? No, it has to be sum over the 3-point operator.
Yeah, in principle, you have contributions to these 3-point functions, for instance, where a multiple number of them overlap. But I'm confused about how you should think about those from the gravity point of view.
Yeah, but usually the one that dominates, if these things are sufficiently sparse in some sense, is the one where you only have one overlap.
Yes, exactly. That's why I was saying, if N3 is 1, then I think everything works out. And you could probably show...
I mean, you get all of it, right? You get all the possible values of N3, yeah. But the one that dominates is N3.1.
Yeah.
Presume that for N4...
What do you mean dominates?
Well, if you have... It's leading in the 1 over N expansion.
Oh, okay, I see. Okay.
Yeah, I guess that's just... So you should think of... Yeah, I guess that's... Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, now for 4-point functions, you're expecting a 4-point function when the theory is a product of 3-point functions.
Yes.
So that's usually...
And that's for the leading piece, that's how it would work.
So for normal theories, you can't have... You'll always have some contribution within 3 equals 1, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Usually, yes.
As long as the seed theory has non-zero OP coefficients, you'll get those.
Okay. I see.
And that'll be the leading term in the expansion.
I see. In the other cases, they're really just things that are sort of fine-tuned. I can think of it as fine-tuned where some coupling constant happens to be zero. Or some, you know, some cancellation between the diagrams and some...
Questions? If not, let's ask.
Thanks.